Okay, now it's recording, so let's continue. So the fourth exercise session, and so this is mainly about the cards modeling. So let's get right into it. So please load the packages and then set the working directory either from the tab session set working directory, SUSE directory, and the place where where's your data. So in the first exercise, we're testing the co-integration, the modeling of co-integrated variables. We're using the monthly data we've used before. So yeah, and we are asked to set two subsamples, one before the September 2008 and one since then. So let's get going. First, let's load the data. Then save the variables and set them as a time series, as a monthly with monthly frequency. Then we'll take the subsamples of both of the series. And then we'll calculate the spread, meaning the difference between the long and the short term rates. And let's plot the spread. Okay, from the spread, we can see that just by eyeballing, one could make an assumption that as if this were an mean reverting series, at least till 2010, so. But afterwards, there seems to be only a downward drift, so. Either it could be the case that the linear combination of the series is co-integrated, that means stationary, or it isn't. So let's start checking that. So first of all, we have to check that both of these series are. I1 series, that means they include a unit root, because unit root is a necessary condition for a co-integration. And there can be a lot of typos in this R code. So here and there I use locks, although we're not using them. Let's start checking the first subsample of the short-term rates. So the unit root here, our null hypothesis is that the series contains a unit root, and then we'll calculate the test statistics, and then we'll compare it to the critical values of the probability distribution. So here are the values. This is below 10%, and this is also below 10%. So in both cases, the null stays in power and we have a unit root in series. So from here on, I will speed a little bit this, as we've done this unit root before. So I assume you're familiar with how the inference is made. So second case, long-term rates. compare the test statistics with the distributional values. In both cases, we have a unit root. Then we'll check the second subsample. We have a unit root and we have a unit root. So as our series are contained on a unit root, we can do a co-invasion. And to strengthen our assumption, let's check the Phillips-Perron unit root test. And also in this case, we have a unit root. And in another case, we have a unit root. We're only doing that for the first subsample. And then to be sure that we have only one unit root and not two or more unit roots, we test the difference of the Bill series. And there's a typo, I have to correct that. So let's check that the difference is stationary. So in the first subsample, we can see that the statistic is higher than each of the critical values in both cases. So we have a stationary series, and let's check the second subsample. Our series is stationary, and then then the long-term rates, we have a stationary series, and second subsample, and the series is stationary. So this means that we have only one unit root in each of the subsamples. So the series don't contain any additional unit roots. So next we can begin the Engel-Granger procedure for testing the co-integration. And here are five parts of the procedure. So first of all, we'll run the OLS for both series. And in this case, this could be done in both ways, but we're only one way. Both ways should result give us the same results. In the first part, we'll run the basic linear model. So TBL is the dependent variable, and the long-term rates are the independent variable. And let's do that for the both subsamples, and then let's check the statistics. So in the first subsample, we have a highly significant coefficient, independent variable, long-term rates, and then our adjusted R-square is moderately high, around 40%. So yeah, that's something. So first of all, we are interested, although this is statistically significant, it could be the case that this relation is in a deeper level spurious. So first of all, we could just check the outer correlation of this residuals of this linear regression. And the other thing is that there's no outer correlation. And when we calculate the test statistics and compare it to the distributional value, we result really minimal p-value. So this means that we have a high outer correlation series. So when we have a statistically significant relationship between the X and U, we have in our case a moderately high or moderate high R squared value, meaning the proportion of this, how much the independent variable of the model can explain from the variation of the model. And then we have a high outer correlation, so this would suggest that we have a spurious. So these all three properties are the properties of the relationship between the variables. This would be the relationship is spurious, but let's check that further on. But before that, let's run the second set. Let's check the summary statistics for the second linear model. And this case, our coefficient is not statistically significant. R squared value is really minimal, and just for sake of fun, we could just check the host autocorrelation. Yeah, we have a high autocorrelation issues. But that was the first part of the model, run the OLS. Then we, in the second part, we save the residuals, and then we run a particular test the unit root. Is there a unit root in the residuals? Okay, so here, if we in the case that our variables would be going to create at 10, unit root test would have to support the stationarity of the residuals. So let's check the unit root of the linear residuals of this first model. So in the first case, the null is unit root. And then we calculate the test statistics and compare them with the critical values. So in the both cases, we have a unit root. So this implies that the relationship between the long-term and short-term rate is spurious. They are not co-integrated. Their linear combination is not stationary. But in this case, we only used zero lag, so let's then secondly use Akaike as an information criteria and see whether the results change or not. And again, we see immediately that we have a unit root in the series. So this means before the September 2008, the relationship between the long-term and short-term rate is spurious. Secondly, let's see whether that's also the case with after the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers. So comparing this statistics with the distributional values below, we see immediately we have a unit root in the series. And secondly, let's do that with the Akaike information criteria, and we see that we have a unit root in the series. So also in the second subsample, the relationship between the long and short-term rate is spurious. But this still doesn't imply that we couldn't check the error correction term or model. But if the co-integration exists, meaning that the linear combination of the short-term and long-term rates is stationary, this would also, we should be able to build an error correction model. But this relationship doesn't go into the only in one way, because it is also the case that we also built an error correction model without co-integration. So the co-integration is not a necessary condition for the ECM. So let's run the OLS for the ECM for the first subsample and for the second, and then check the summary statistics of the first subsample. Here we'll see that the residuals are statistically significant at the 5% level. So this is really a strange result. So this would suggest that these variables are co-integrated, although their linear combination is not stationary. So this is a contradictory result and means that there's something really wrong with our model. And then the second subsample. In this case, the residuals are not significant, but the difference between the long-term rates in the second subsample are significant. So when the differences are significant, then there's a significant short-run relationship, not long-run relationship. That the spread is able to forecast the changes of the short-term changes, but not the long-term changes. Oh, yeah, maybe we could write a predict is a better way to say this. So this begs a question: is there a As our results are contradictory overall, at least it would suggest that there it begs a question to ask, is there some kind of regimes with between the samples, and in such a way that this regime shift could also affect the level changes. But those are just questions for further research before. And here, let's rather next go in diagnostics of the model and check the autocorrelation of the residuals. So in the first case, let's first run the Box-Pearce autocorrelation test. And in the autocorrelation test, the null is no autocorrelation. And when the null is rejected, and in this case, it's rejected really firmly, this implies that there's an autocorrelation in series. So this means that our residuals are not behaving well. And this also means that most probably we have misspecified our model. So first thing to do is to check whether this misspecification is due to nonlinearities. So then let's run the same autocorrelation test using the Lumbox test. And if only difference is that Box-Pearce tests the raw residuals, but Lumbox tests their squares. So when we take the squares of the residuals and do similar test, we also reject the null quite firmly. So we indeed seem to have autocorrelation series. And that was for the first subsample. And let's do the same test for the second subsamples, Box-Pearce, normal residuals. And there's some typo. But in the second subsample, our p-value is below 0.05. So this implies that we have autocorrelation at the level of 5%, but not at the level of 1%. Let's check the same test with squared residuals, and we get a fairly similar result. We have an autocorrelation at the 5% level. But in any case, when we compare this diagnostics between the subsamples, we find that our second subsample seems to be behaving better than the first one. But in a deeper level, we cannot conclude anything any relevant information from these results.
Does this mean that we can't use the error correction model?
We can use error correction model, but so in the Engler-Ranger testing procedure, I'll present here the procedure as a whole. So first, let's divide this procedure into two different stages. In the first stage, we test whether there's a unit root in the linear combination of these series. And in our case, there was a unit root. So unit root in the linear combination between two variables implies that the relationship is spurious. But this doesn't imply that we cannot use ECM. So the only thing that this implies is that we don't have a long-run relationship. But still, we run an error correction model to study, for example, the variables, not the long-run relationship. So this is the result of the ECM, although this result doesn't strengthen the assumption of the co-intuition. So say in another way that although our relationship between the variables is spurious, we can still use ECM. But if there's a long-run relationship, then the ECM would have to hold also. then there would have to be an equivalence between these two stages of the procedure. The linear combination would have to be stationary, and secondly, the residual of the model would have to be significant. So then let's go into the second question. So now we are starting to testing conditional heteroscedasticity, this whether this effect is in the models. And we're doing the exercises 2, 3, and 4 using the currencies data. So first let's clear the global environment and then load the libraries. And then here is our data, and we'll take logs of data. So first of all, so we are testing heteroscedasticity. So this means that our model has two equations, one for the mean equation, another. So if it is the case that there's only conditional heteroscedasticity, only the conditional heteroscedasticity is driving the behavior of the series, then it should be the case that when we look at this plot, that all of the variation in the series is coming from the variance, and the mean equation is just the series is fluctuating around the mean, and the mean is here at 0. So just eyeballing the residuals of the returns, just by eyeballing the returns of the British pound, we could make an assumption that this is the case, that only the residual is moving the behavior series. So as our residual doesn't have a constant, is not constant, rather it is varying over time, we can see fluctuating behavior, or take another way, that there's volatility clustering going on. Sometimes the volatility is higher, and sometimes the volatility is decreasing, and around observation 2600, there's a volatile period, and this is the financial crisis, and then we'll see that the volatility is slow decreasing, and around here, around 3000, it's fairly minimal, and then we'll see huge spike there, and this huge spike is Brexit. So let's start doing the regressions. So first of all, we'll just regress the returns on a constant. And let's save the residuals. And this is our model. Yes, from the estimate of the residuals, we see that it is almost non-existent, although really, really close to zero. So this means that individual observations shouldn't be dictating the mean of the series. Then let's save the residuals and square them. And secondly, let's estimate the arch modeling. So here we are regressing the residuals on its lags, and here we are using 5 lags. Here the lag that is the closest from the lag of the dependent variable is the t minus 1 value of the residuals. So it's the numbers work here the opposite way, like the normal intuition. So the number 5 here is the t minus 1 lack of the the first value be regressing here in the model. So let's run the regression and check the summary statistics. And here, before we start to interpret it, the statistical results, let's be sure that we understand what we are estimating here. So we're using here the squared residuals as a, they're SOX as a independent variable. So think these variables here take the square root of the variable, so think it only as a raw residuals. So these variables refer to the volatility SOX that are volatility SOX of the previous periods. Standardized volatility SOX. So this is our model. Let's first check that the general assumptions of the ARCH model apply, and one of the assumptions is that the sum of these squared residuals cannot be over one. So if we add these five values, it will be like not even one half, even lower that. So that property holds. Then secondly, we don't have any negative values, so that also holds. And I forgot to say that. So when we sum these values of these coefficients and they are below one, that indicates that we have a mean reversal on the process. So think it just this way, that sometimes the volatility increases, but it has an over time a tendency if the volatility increases too much over, it's say like its mean values over time, it has a tendency to decrease again. So this is what mean reversion means here. But there's some constant element in the volatility. And then it's also important to be able to interpret what these coefficients here, the values here, mean. So usually these alpha parameters are only below 0.05, and this estimate implies that the markets are behaving quite stably. But if the value is over 1.1, this implies that there's a high uncertainty on a market going on. So here we see pretty high values from here, and then we'll see some lower values. So then secondly, let's start our economic interpretation of the model. So, or let's switch into an economic point of view. We can see here that 4 out of 5 of these residuals are statistically significant. So this implies when one of the residuals is significant, we are performing the following test. Our null of the test is that the squared residuals are homoscedastics, but when we reject this assumption, we have a heteroscedasticity. So overall, 4 out of 5 implies pretty high and persistent heteroscedasticity in the model. And also what's peculiar here is that our intercept is statistically significant and its value is relatively high. So the intercept here is the constant element in the variation. And when we look at this plot, we can see that it is changing quite rapidly over time. So when we have such a high constant value relative to the values of the residuals in the series, meaning that the non-varying part is quite high relative to the variating path of the residuals, it could be well be the case that we have misspecified our models, that our model doesn't catch the real volatility in the series. So then let's start looking at the different graphs to understand more in detail how the residuals are behaving. So first let's save the residuals and then we'll take the time series of them. Then we have some fitted values there. They're actually not needed, but this line here is irrelevant. So first of all, let's plot the fitted values of the model against the residuals of the model. So here on the x-axis, we have the fitted values of the model and then the residuals are on the u-axis. We see that the relationship between them is decreasing over time. So this decrease here implies that there's a systematic relationship between the two variables. And when there's a systematic change between the two variables, this implies that there's a heteroscedasticity in the model. Secondly, let's just plot the residuals of the ARCH5 model. And we can see that here in the September 2008, that was more volatile period. And then again, the Corona 1 year ago was a volatile period, but the outlier of the Brexit is something from the other realm here. It's really huge spike. So that would imply that the Brexit is a huge outlier that is also affecting here in the model. And that is something we have to somehow take into account. Then let's see the squared residuals. So just take the square of the previous residuals. Yeah. The value of the Brexit seems to be so high that it exceeds our scaling. So let's change the scaling a little bit. And we'll see that, yeah, the Brexit is alone over there, and then there are some other values. Then let's check the histogram of the residuals. We'll see that this histogram is rightly skewed right, meaning that the probability mass is on the left-hand side of the zero value. Then so the first one was the histogram, and now we're using the probability distribution here. So the probability distribution also is right skewed, meaning the mass is on the left hand side. So it seems to be the case that our residuals isn't behaving that good. So let's then compare our residuals to the residuals of the normal distribution. So let's do it in this way. So these are the residuals of our model, how they're behaving relative to theoretical quantiles, meaning the theoretical values of the probability distribution. And let's draw that line there. So if our residuals would be all the way on this line, from this diversion, we can see that there are a lot of outliers that are affecting our model. So it seems to be the case that it will be most probably really difficult to estimate or find the right underlying model because the outliers are affecting so strongly in our models. And it could be also be the case that we should individually try to control our outliers in the model to be able to find the underlying true model behind the data generating process. But before we are not going into that in these exercises, and next we're starting to test about whether there's a structural change in the model. So here, like before, we are using the September 2008 as a threshold value and subdividing our sample into with respect to that time period. So then let's take our first subsample so that we could test the effect of the conditional heteroscedasticity before the September 2008. And let's do the similar linear regressions as earlier. So first of all, we'll regress the returns in the subsamples on a constant. Yeah, we seem to get a pretty non-existent value and not so much there. So let's then save the residuals and square them and start studying to arch effect. So again, the null is in each of these coefficients that the squared residuals are homoscedastic, meaning that they behave nicely. So we can see here that 2 out of 5 residuals are that we reject the null, and we have a heteroscedasticity in these lacs. But here we can see that in the previous case, this model above, we can see that here we have also significant lacs on t minus 4 and t minus 5, meaning that the disturbances are also affecting from the longer period. But in this case, these lacs are not any more significant. So it implies that when we divide our sample, the outliers don't seem to be affecting that much into the model. The thing here is that we look at t minus 3 lack value, we have a negative value here, and this is a no-no in the arch modeling. So this violates the general assumption of the arch modeling, and basically this implies that our model is not stationary, and we can throw this model away. But still, it gives us some hints, although this model is not very good. Gives us some hints, we shouldn't rely that firmly on these hints because our model is not that good. So then let's check what changes in the second subsample. So let's run the same procedure as earlier. And again, in the second subsample, meaning after the September 2008, lacs at the longer length become significant. Here, 3 or 4, at a level of 5%, so we don't take that T minus 3 lac into account. 3 out of 4 alphas are statistically significant from the 0, implying a heteroscedasticity. And if we want to take the 10% level into account, then it would be the 4 out of 5. So comparing this result of the second subsample to the first one, this would suggest that the outliers are dominating the model here. So that was the part A, and then we are going to part B. So this is a card modeling for the Japanese yen returns. And then we are asked to do different specifications. So first of all, we want to understand what the card model brings into modeling of conditional or heteroscedasticity. So as in the case of alpha parameters, when they are below the 0.05, this implies that the markets are behaving quite stably. And if they're below 0.51, there's an uncertainty in the model. So as the alpha parameters refer to the volatility shock of the T minus previous periods, the beta represents the effects of the conditional variance of the previous periods. And this is the very effect in the Karts modeling. And while the alpha parameters are usually rather small, beta parameters are rather high, and they're usually varying between the levels of 0.8 and 1. So when the value is this high that and significant, it implies that there's a persistence of volatility in the modeling. It is not only about the shocks of the previous periods, but there is a persistent element in the volatility. And again, we have to always look that the values of the alpha and beta parameters do not exceed the value of the 1. When they come close to 1, higher the value of the beta, if the value of the beta is high, this implies at the same time that the alpha is small. And this means that the higher the value of the beta, higher the persistency in the volatility. And when we interpret alpha and beta parameters together, they are measuring how the volatility shocks disappears over time. When there's a strong volatility shock happening from the alpha model, or rather, I should say that volatility shock can also happen at the same period, meaning at the present period. So when the strong shock appears, this strong shock is divided into two different parameters, or alpha and beta parameters. And again, it's the same as earlier that when values of the sum of the values parameters is below 1, there's a mean reversal in the model. But if it's the case that the values are approximately 1, this means that there's a unit root in the variance. And when there's a unit root, we could, for example, if we have a unit root, we could try E-Karts modeling. The point of the E-Karts modeling is that if there's a unit root in the variance, sometimes the unit root is diverting the model away, but still it's not diverging that much that sometimes it's the model is becoming back to the limits that we can estimate it again. So there's a unit root is, so to say, driving the model beyond the critical threshold, but also it doesn't exceed too far away from that threshold that it can't be estimated. So next, let's start Karts modelings. And first of all, we used default properties of the R. So we are actually, if we only estimate Karts this way, we're actually estimating Arma-Karts model. So when we're using R, we have to be careful about what we're doing. That is some general stuff, not that important. And then we'll estimate our Karts model, the default assumption of the R, and make the following results. So the equation and the variance equations are here. All the parameters of both of these equations are here. A1 and M1 parameters, these parameters of the equation, implying that there's a negative memory effect from the previous period, and also implying that there's a high persistence between the periods in the mean equation. This is the constant of the variance equation, and alpha and beta are the parameters of the variance equation. First of all, we can see here that the sum of the alpha 1 and beta 1 does not exceed 1, so and neither of these value is negative, so we're not violating basic Karts assumptions. In the first case, we're just using the standard errors. In the second case, this is the same estimates for using the robust standard error. So these are the so-called sandwich standard errors. The basic difference between the standard case and robust case is that robust standard errors take the non-linearities in the receipts of the into account. But this doesn't imply that. So standard errors take the non-linearities into account, and then we have a model that is special that models the non-linearities into of the series. So first of the question, it begs a question to ask that do the robust standard errors when they are modeling non-linearities affect the standard affect the parameters that are modeling the non-linearities of the series? And the answer is no. We see here just compare these values of the omega alpha and beta 1, they're the same. So using the robust standard errors do not affect the estimates of the parameters at all. They only affect the standard errors. And in general, it's usually better use the robust standard errors, but that shouldn't be interpreted or thought as some guideline that can be violated in any case. So rather it would be said that usually these are just the better ones, but they're not optimal in every case. Then we have information criteria. We can skip that. And then modeling is also giving some diagnostics. So here we're seeing autocorrelation. So model is the autocorrelation, and in every case, the null of the autocorrelation test is that there's no autocorrelation, and we reject null if the value is below 1.5, and it isn't rejected in any case. This is the second test of autocorrelation, and according to it, we also have a pretty nicely behaving residual, no autocorrelation. And then we're testing the conditional heteroscedasticity, and in this case, the null is not rejected, meaning that our model is behaving nicely. And then we have a new stability test, and this new test is about tests whether there's a structural change in the time series, and a structural change means that if there's a structural change, then the relations between the variables change over time. So another hypothesis of a new test is that values of the parameters are constant or zero, and this is also the same. When we're talking about the joint test, we're testing that they all are zero. And if null is rejected, and which is the alternative hypothesis, means that the variance is positive. So here we have different tests. First of all, we have joint statistics and we have individual statistics. Okay, here you have signed bias tests. Okay, that's another test. So yeah, to test the stability of the parameters, take the value of the joint statistics here, 1.87 compared to the real value. So we see when we compare this to 1.68, we would reject the null at the level of 5%, implying that there's some the relationship between the parameters are jointly are changing over time. And then we perform this test for the same test for individual statistics and compare these values. Let's take here the value of the beta 1, for example, it falls between 5 and 1%. So at the level of the 5%, there's also relationship between variables is changing over time. So there we have some problem. We have some kind of problem in our modeling. Then let's check the sign bias test. So the null hypothesis of the sign bias test is that the null is that positive or negative shocks have the same impact, meaning that there is no asymmetry on volatility. So when we look at the whole sign bias test and then test the individual either negative or positive sign bias, the null stays in power in every case. But when we look at the joint test, we reject the null, implying that there is an asymmetry in volatility. Then there are some Pearson stats. Yeah, it's an internal acuteness of the fit model, and they're rejected in every case. But let's keep them. So overall, we run our ARMA 1-1 models. We found some problems in modeling. So then let's just play by a raw CARS 1-1 model and see how our results differ. So from the optimal parameters, parameters here, but alpha 1 parameter has about the same value as earlier, 1.74, it's about the same as earlier, but let's check that. It is about the same as earlier. And likewise, our parameter is about the same. So if we leave two variables from the mean equation out, this doesn't affect the variance at all. Actually, it seems to be the case. Informational criteria seem to be about the same. They seem to be a little better in the previous case, but the difference is not that much that huge. So when the difference is not that huge, we could think that the model with smaller amount of variables is a better one, the principle of parsimony. And again, when you do diagnostics, that's the autocorrelation of the model. Our model seems to be performing quite well. There's no autocorrelation here. The null hypothesis, no autocorrelation stays in power in each case. Likewise here, it stays in power in each case. And then when we look at the, when we test the conditional heteroscedasticity, it also indicates that after the modeling, we don't have any additional conditional heteroscedasticity that our model is not taking into account. So our model passes the test now. And then we find that there's some the stability of parameters, that there are some problems with the stability of the parameters. And so compare these test values with critical values, and you'll see immediately that we have some problems with the stability of the parameters. And then again, sign biases, there are some joint effect bias in the all variables, but not in the individual cases. So then let's continue. Then let's do the same thing using the student's t-distribution. So here we're specifying that we use student's t-distribution, and then we'll just print the same values as earlier. So this is again our model. AR1 and MI1 coefficients are missing. Only difference with the previous one is the shape coefficient here. This is something that we can skip here. Basically, this value in itself doesn't say that must, but it is the value that can be used when we want to calculate the kurtosis or skewness of models. So this is the statistic we're using in those cases. But in our case, we can skip that. Information growth over than earlier in the earlier model. Still, there seems to be, when we just look at the p-values here, the autocorrelation test, it seems to be the case that there's no autocorrelation in the model. And also, when we perform autocorrelation test for the squared residuals, there is no autocorrelation. And when we test the conditional heteroscedasticity, it seems to be the case that there is no such a thing in our model. And then our Newport's stability test, joint test is even higher than earlier. Here we have actually seems to be the case that with the student's distribution, we have more problems with the stability of the parameters than in the earlier case. And yeah, sign bias test, the results are the same as earlier.
Should we use always the stability distribution when we use our?
I'd rather say that it is just an alternative. It can be used. It can be used, and when we're using it, we have a benefit of testing the skewness, and it takes better the skewness and. What's the other kurtosis into account? So, in our case, while we are continuing with the student distribution here, it is based on this fact. So, as we remember from the plots earlier, we saw that our model, our residuals are not behaving that well. That there was some skewness and kurtosis in our residuals. So. We continue with the student distribution because it takes them better into account.
Doesn't your theory say something about that it follows either normal or standard distribution?
Yeah, so the student distribution, when we're thinking about the distribution asymptotically, hopefully you understand what the word I try to say. So when it's about asymptotics, is about asymptotic, so meaning our size of the sample is increasing, and here we have almost 5,000 observations. So then the student distribution convergence on the normal converges into the normal distribution, approximately converges into the normal distribution. So meaning that they are different distributions, but they are our distribution becomes more approximately normal. This is a highly technical point, and right now I'd have to think a little bit more in detail about the details of this distribution of things. But I wasn't, so unfortunately we have to skip that one. So
no problem.
So we were doing CART 1-1 modeling with the student distribution, and then we were for the whole sample, and next we are doing this thing for the subsamples. So let's first take the subsample and then run the same modeling. Or actually, before we continue, do Alexandra have anything to add on this question about the normal distribution and the student distribution?
Actually, is that only instead that like the also option, and you know, specify either you want to use the normal distribution or student distribution, but nothing else.
So let's then run test the CART 1-1 effect in the first subsample. So again, we see from our results that parameters are not negative and they are below the value of 1. They are significant, and when they are significant, that's a good thing, because that means that there's some statistical value of using the CART model. Meaning that if they're not negative, not significant, that would mean that it could be the case that the variance is constant. Now it seems to be the case that there's some support for the model that the underlying there's some conditional heteroscedasticity in the underlying series, the data generating process. And then again, diagnostics in the first case, we pass. In the case of standardized residuals, we pass the autocorrelation test, and then we square the residuals and pass the autocorrelation test, and then we pass the conditional heteroscedasticity test. And then again, something is not right with the stability of the parameters. There's something that is not right. Intuitively, from the plots, we saw that there were these huge outliers in our series, so it may well be the case that these outliers are affecting the stability of the parameters, so that they're affecting stability tests, so that we have to reject them. So to say it in another way, if we controlled for example, the Brexit event, we could pass the stability test. The sign biases seem to work right now. In each of these cases, we passed the test. So I'll have to rephrase myself. I mentioned the Brexit earlier, so. In particular, with this subsample, that cannot be the case, because we are testing the subsample before the September 2008, so the Brexit happened, of course, after that. But the main point here is that we could try to find some outliers before the September 2008 and test and see how they affect the stability of the parameters. At the beginning of the 2000, there was this dot-com bubble, so it could be the case that it could affect the currencies. I'm not sure. But it could be the case. And also, the great financial crisis actually started before the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers. So there are also outliers from August 2007 till September, August 2008. So they are also included in this subsample. So there are strong outliers also in this subsample, although they might not be the worst possible cases of the outliers, like after the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers. So then let's check the same stats after the bankruptcy. And again, our model is looking at the optimal parameters In the normal case and with the case of standard errors, our parameters are behaving quite nicely. There's nothing to add there. And then in the diagnostics, no autocorrelation. With the standardized residuals, then squared residuals, no autocorrelations. Arch-Allen-Best, the null stays in power in each case. And then there are again problems with the stability of the parameters. And then some joint biases, joint effect biases in the parameters. So in general, the results seem to be the same in both subsamples, so that we have a pretty similar, our results are pretty similar before the Lehman's bankruptcy and after that. So we could then try to try some others if we could dig some deeper effects in the series. So then we are going in the third question and estimating the asymmetries, asymmetric and E-cards models. So here we are running a cluster Jacanathan and Runkle model and then E-cards model for the same chain return. So first of all, this GJR card model belongs to the subsummary of the threshold cards models. And what these kind of threshold models add into cards modeling, that is the leverage effect. So what this leverage effect, it is what it is modeling. So here, the difference is that we bring an indicator function in the variance equation. So this indicator function models the quadratic response of volatility to either negative or either good or bad news. And this indicator function is a good addition into the modeling, because usually it is the case that the negative news are that the markets react to the negative news more strongly than to the positive news. For example, for example, some company gives, so it is quite, it is minus, at least minus 10% day could be the case that, and compared to the case that it would give good news, it would like be plus 5 or something. So it is usually the case that the markets react to the bad news more strongly than the good news. So this indicator function allows, so when we have a negative shock here in the model, this indicator function is activated. And this allows us to bring the asymmetries better into our modeling. So first of all, let's look what's happening before the Lehman's bankruptcy. So this is basic GJR CARS model without the mean equation, and let's check the results. So again, our parameters are behaving nicely, and here we can see that our gamma one parameter is positive. So this means that the good news are more relevant than the bad news. So this, to say it a little bit more exactly, that when we have a positive gamma one parameter, so this means that good news have a greater impact on the conditional volatility than the negative news. Here it is interesting that when we're using standard errors, the gamma one parameter is significant of 5%, but when we're using robust, and this is so to say the better case, then it would lose is significant. It would be only be significant at the level of 10%. So this means that our results are a little bit mixed here. Or to say it in another way, that there seems to be more into a underlying series that we're not taking into account. And at least although this is significant at the level of the 5%. It isn't significant at the level of the 1%, so not strongly statistically significant, but statistically significant, moderately statistically significant, and here the second case, vaguely statistically significant, meaning at the level of 10%. Still, our model passed the received autocorrelation tests, and then there are no problems with the conditional heteroscedasticity, but again, we have problems with the stability of the parameter state. The relationship between the parameters seem to be changing over time. So something is affecting our modeling in a deeper level, and it seems to be the case that we are not able to catch what that is. We don't know it. And then, what about after it? After the bankruptcy, looking at the optimal parameters, we are not violating any general cost assumptions, and also in second case, it seems our leverage effect is moderately statistically significant, so this is a more firm result than with the first subsample. Again, the sign is positive, meaning that the good news has had a higher impact on a greater impact on the conditional volatility than the negative news. Then we pass again the autocorrelation tests and the LM tests, and again some problems with the stability of the parameters. So let's specify our CARTS model a little bit from the GJR model to exponential CARTS model. So exponential means here that shock has a more exponentially negative shock would have a more exponentially exploding effect than in the previous case. So let's try this modeling if we can catch something. And the good thing with the eCARTS modeling, when we compare that to the normal CARTS modeling, is that it uses logs of alpha logs. So when using logs is allowed, alpha and beta parameters can be negative, and we are not violating any general assumption of the CARTS modeling. But still, it has to be the case that the beta parameter is below one. So these are we'll run the similar code as earlier, but now we're just specifying here the eCARTS model. And yeah, although alpha one is negative, that's not a big issue here because log, so we're not, and the beta is below one, so we're not violating any general modeling assumption of the CARTS. And then we have a highly significant common parameter here. And a positive meaning that the positive good news have a greater impact on the conditional volatility. And then diagnostics for short, standardized residuals, no autocorrelations, squared residuals, no autocorrelations, LM tests, no conditional heteroscedasticity that is not taken into account. Then our stability of parameter seems to be getting worse. So this is interesting. And then the alpha, individual alpha one parameter is not high. So as the alpha is about volatility shocks of previous periods, it seems to be there's something there can be these huge outliers are affecting our modeling. So that was before the bankruptcy. Then let's see after the Lehman. And again, general conditions are high, but the gamma parameter is so good. So it's really high value, 1.80. So previously, let's compare that to the previous case. In the previous case, we have 0.12. So that's already a higher value. But so let's compare to the eCARTS values to the GJR CARTS model. So in the previous part, the exercise, we had a gamma value of 0.067, and then the eCARTS model we have already doubled. In the first case, we had to double that value, and then in the second case, three times the value. So think this in this way, that in the previous, the 0.06 is the more normal value, and these values are more rare. So the interpretation becomes really interesting. So this would suggest that positive news have really high value on the conditional variance. So positive news would be affecting the exchange rate, really have really high impact on the conditional volatility. So that just intuitively that doesn't just make sense that all that much. So positive news would be so significant. So what I'm going to say in another way is that economically these results are not that credible. So although these are numbers, they don't or I'd rather say this in that way, or at least I'm having problems understanding what the reality under them could be. And I'm more prone to think about that we have rather problems with modeling that than that this result, that this would be the, this would really be the process that's the data generating process. So then in the last part, I have already talked about 1.5 hours, but let's go this third exercise through, and then we'll have some pause here, some break. So let's check some plots here. So let's save the residuals before the Lehman's bankruptcy and just plot them. So the back lines there are the actualized values, and then the green values here are our modeling values. So it seems to be the case that our modeling pretty nicely together with the actualized values. So of course the actualized values are more extreme because they are individual values, and we are modeling here the persistency and then these high shocks at the same time. So they seem to be going quite nicely behaving together with the actualized values. And then we'll just check the residuals without the squares. So yeah, so just by looking at this plot, we can see that there are really strong asymmetries here going on. But although we used specifically that modeling that's meant to model the asymmetries, we were not able to catch these asymmetries. Thus, looking at this plot, we can see this huge negative spikes here. And according to our model, it would suggest that the positives are so highly significant. So it's to say, probably Juhat has said this to you many times. So although you find some statistically significant results, you should also go back to the data and start to deeper digging on what's possibly happening there. Are these statistic results to say in another way credible? And then after the Lehman's bankruptcy, again, it seems to be the case that there really is really extreme effects, and our model is going quite nicely with them. It is also a conditional logic in the persistence of the volatility account. So, but it seems to be behaving quite nicely. And then let's check the residuals without. And again, we see here that there are really strong asymmetries here. And just by eyeballing the residuals, it would be more credible to assume that the negative news are effective. Okay, that was the third exercise. So we have only one exercise left this time. So let's have a break now, 15-minute break now. Okay, let's continue. Alexandra, do you want to show anything in Stata?
So far, the results are like exactly the same. I was just thinking maybe in the end I will go through the codes in Stata briefly.
Okay.
No, I mean, like, you can continue now, but, like, later when you are done with the exercise, I will go through the codes then overall.
Excuse me, your microphone is off.
Oh yeah, like.
Okay. Thanks. Okay. So I'll begin again. So fourth exercise, and here we are asked to do a cartoon meme model with 1 lakh for the Japanese yen return. So. First of all, we ask what cartoon meal, how does this model differ from the previous models? And the difference is that it adds the heteroscedastics term in the conditional mean equation. So that the mean equation becomes dependent on the variance. So in the previous models, the modeling is, or the estimation is start done in two phases in that way that the first of all, the model runs the mean equation regression, and then secondly, the variance equation is estimated. So here we have our mean model is also dependent on the heteroscedasticity. So standard error in mean. So here we add standard error in our mean equation. In the second case, we are adding variance, but here we are adding, here it is a square root of variance. So
Sorry, guys. Looks like something happened with Juha's Zoom. Let's wait a little bit.
So again, we are having some technical problems. But let me share the R screen again. So it is a good thing that you, Alexandra, are recording this session, because I just lost my video. So this is really, this is really annoying, but
I just made you host again.
But yeah, let's so Cartesian mean model. Cartesian mean model, so let's run the code. And then let's check the results. So again, if we concentrate on the conditional variance equation, we'll see that everything is fine. The sum of alpha and beta is below one, no negative values, and they support that we have a varying conditional variance here in case. And then let's look the new element in our model, the arch m parameter in the mean equation. So first of all it doesn't matter that it is negative, but its value is non-existent basically, so there's nothing. It doesn't economically, it doesn't seem to add much, but at the same time, it is, if we look at its p-values, it's statistically insignificant. So in general, a Cartesian mean model doesn't seem to add much in the modeling. And here again, looking at the diagnostics, autocorrelation, there's no autocorrelation in our model, and we alarm test results are also fine. But strangely, Newbold stability tests are performing a little bit better than earlier. Sign biases test results are like the same. But yeah, let's try another specification. The standard error in mean doesn't seem to add much. And then let's try variance in mean. And again, our results are about the same as earlier. The conditional variance equation is fine, but our arch-am effect is first of all almost non-existent and statistically insignificant. Otherwise, our results are they're a little bit better than in the and with the case of standard error, but it still seems to be the case that the variance in mean doesn't seem to add that much. So then let's remove. Oh dear! I seem to forgot to say that in the earlier estimates we have also added the AR1 coefficient in the model. So let's see then. But yeah, although we added AR1 model in our equation, in the both cases it was the same result. The effect is fairly small and insignificant. But yeah, let's then next try again. that we exclude the AR1 parameter from the mean equation just to check that if it complicates the estimation procedure, so that if we remove the additional complexity from our model, that we will get better results. Okay, these are the results without the AR1 root, and they're almost the same as earlier. Although the conditional variance equation, everything is fine there, the Arch-Am effect is non-existent and insignificant. And then our results are pretty same as earlier. So in general, it seems to be the case that Cartesian mean is not related to the data generating process, and we better try some other modeling next. Here's some additional code here. So if you want to do forecasting with the CARTS model, here's some code written for you, but we'll skip this code this time. But this code could be helpful for you in some time. It does the same forecasting procedure as in the second exercise, that first we're doing the static forecast, and then we're actually this time we're doing rolling one step forecast. So we are using rolling window here. So that's just some additional features, but we'll skip them here. So in the last part, in the 4B part, we're going to multivariate CARTS modeling, and for modeling the returns of all currencies. So we are trying to find whether there's some dynamic conditional correlations in the true model. So first of all, this is just, let's take the time series of the data. And then because we're doing multivariate CARTS, let's form our matrix. So here we have three rows, and each of them has almost 5,000 observations. Here, if we compare these estimation methods to VAR modeling, here the order of the variable doesn't matter. And why doesn't it matter? It is because we are using here the Engels DCC CARTS modeling, and it is performed in two steps. So why doesn't it matter? Because in the first stage, we're estimating these CARTS models separately. We're doing univariate CARTS 1-1 modeling. And after this, so to say it in another way, it doesn't matter what's the place of the series, because each of them are estimated separately. And then in the second part, we're taking we're doing a second order estimation in our modeling to study the dynamic correlation between these models. Alternatively, it is possible to do this multivariate CARTS model each of the equation at the same time, applying the maximum likelihood optimization. But it has its own problems. So let's begin with the first stage. This is the, here we are just doing the basic cards, univariate cards models. So we're performing three cards model, cards estimations at the same time. So the, and it, it prints some results, but these are just the preliminary results. Still, we can see here that we're all the CARTS parameters, we're not violating any general conditions of the CARTS modeling. And in the second stage, we do the DCC CARTS modeling. So what are the benefits of this kind of modeling? So if we are, for example, interested in how the returns of the different assets vary over time with respect to one another, meaning that there is a, we are interested in the dynamic correlation between the different assets, here three currencies. This is one way to model the dynamic behavior between this, so the cross effect of these currencies. So the basic idea is to go beyond the basic correlation and so what we are doing here, we are decomposing the covariance matrices into conditional standard deviation and conditional matrix. And we want to use as little parameters as possible. And the idea behind that is simple, that when we use smaller amount of parameters, our model is more, it is more simple, and simple here means that it is more accurate. So if we added some additional complexity into our modeling, although it might, for example, result in a higher informational values, these additional parameters could make the estimation procedure more complex, so that we couldn't find the underlying process what we are trying to estimate. So this here, this code specifies our, here, first we specify our CARTS part and then the correlation part and the distribution we are using. And when we are using free series, we need to use multivariate distribution. Then we specify a little bit further our CARTS modeling. So here we are. Here we are specifying a little bit further our modeling, and let's us check the results of this. This is the DCC CARTS estimation, the fitting of the parameters. And here our list of optimal parameters is quite long. Here, if we look the first column here on the here, we'll see the series in question. So first of all, we have the euro returns, and then secondly, we have the British pounds returns. So these are the individual CARTS estimates. And then here we have the Japanese yen returns, and at the bottom of everything, our DCC CARTS parameters. So first 12 parameters are the basic CARTS parameters as earlier, and the two last one are the dynamic correlation parameters. So like in the CART modeling, we are interested in the joint significance of these parameters, and the joint significance could be tested using the AF test or LM test. But with this values being so high, we can be pretty sure that these parameters are jointly significant. So like in the univariate CARTs, we are interested in the joint significance of alpha and beta. We are also thinking, when we are thinking about the dynamic conditional correlations, we are also interested in the joint significance of the alpha parameter and beta parameter. So like in the case of univariate CARTs, the joint significance tells us that it is good thing to use the conditional heteroscedastic modeling. So instead of modeling the variance as a constant, it is a good thing to allow it to vary over time. And if in the case of univariate CARTs, these parameters would not be jointly significant, then the constant assumption of the constant conditional variance would maybe bring us more further. So here also, we are interested in the joint significance of these, and these seem to be, these parameters are so significant as the parameters for short can be, really strongly statistically significant. So what does this mean? So when this means that there's a time varying dependence between the risk and return. Yeah, one additional thing would have been better to set a little bit earlier, but it is also the case that these DCCA and DCCB parameters have to comply with the general restrictions of the CARTs assumptions, and this meaning that these parameters cannot be negative and their sum cannot exceed one. So this also means that we have a mean reversal in the dynamic conditional correlation. So these are just, so what we are modeling here, we can check the individual values of these estimations we have here. So here in the first row, we'll save the covariances, and then we'll calculate their correlations. And this code tells us what kind of data we have here. So we have three times of three matrix for each observations here in the series, and that means almost 5,000 observations. And if we want to specify the values of the last day from our series, it can be done using this code. And here we see that here we see the correlations, correlations between the series. And if we want to, for example, look at here, what's the correlations of the returns of the British pound or the euro pounds, we could use this code, or alternatively, this gives us the same result. So then let's do some plotting. Let's see how our data works. So these are the dynamic correlations of the British pound and euro return series. And important here that first of all, till around 2007, till the beginning of the financial crisis, so the August 2007 is the starting point of the financial crisis that lasted around 2 years, and Lehman Brothers was the peak point of the financial crisis. So we see that the correlation is pretty stable early autumn of 2007, and then there seems to be some structural change in the series. The correlation is not behaving like it used to behave. So then we can see from the 2008 till the beginning 2011 that the series become more volatile, and then there's the volatility decreases again a little bit, and then there seems to be really huge breakup afterwards, and the series become really volatile afterwards. So here it is interesting, would be interesting to check in detail what has happened here in the Britain. So here are these huge spikes around 2014. It could be this, for example, this huge negative, but this huge spike downwards could be related to the European Central Bank's beginning quantitative easing, meaning that economically interpretation would be that when the European Central Bank is more actively buying everything than the British Central Bank, that it affects negatively into currency. Yeah, this, but for short, this periods after 2040 seem to be really volatile, and it isn't that straightforward even where the Brexit is happening here. So this is the Euro British pound series returns. So for short, there seems to be a lot of going on, and it would suggest that further studying the details, what's economically happening there. So then, let's plot all of the three correlations. DCC correlations, And above we had the series we looked earlier, and below we have the Euro Japan returns and the British Pound Japan returns. So when the yen is used as a nominator, now I'm mixing that again. That seems to be always the hardest part to remember. What's the which side the so the nominator no denominator is the underside of the ratio. So here I'm trying to refer to the one below. So it's the denominator. So here we have the 10 returns as a denominator, and the series seem to be behaving quite. Their correlation is pretty firm, that they're behaving really similarly. So this would suggest that there's not much that Japanese yen adds either to the Euro series or to the pound series. It could be also it could also be the other case that it has some impact, but we don't know it. But from here on, at least the Euro and British Pound seem to be behaving quite similarly.
Are all of these returns calculated from the exchange rate with US dollar?
Yes, that's the data, but here we are using some. Yeah, exactly. All of these currencies are valuated against the US dollar.
So could it be that there is some multicollinearity, like if, yeah.
Multicollinearity implying actually in one sense that is true, and in what sense that is true is that in a sense that's the theory of covered interest parity. And when we look at this Euro British GDP returns, it is quite stable, and this actually refers to the period when the economic theory of covered interest rate parity held firmly. So I'm not going into details with this theory, but basically this theory, although this is a economic theory, it said that there's no arbitrage that could be made from the different currency series. So after this arbitrage relationship has broke up in the great financial crisis, and in the case of the, I'll plot this series here because it's easier to look from here. So from around August 2007, this economic relationship of arbitrage, theoretical relationship, broke up, and there became deviations. So in that sense, when we mean about multicollinearity, about if we think about that as a linear combination or linearity between the different series, in that sense it is true, but there's no multicollinearity in the statistical sense here, that implying that if we have in a statistical sense multicollinearity, then our matrix would not invert and we wouldn't be able to do the estimations here. But in an economic theory sense, we could think about multicollinearity, and the multicollinearity here means the break deviations in the covered interest rate parity covered interest rate parity But in the statistical sense, we are not having any multiple linearities here. But yeah, economically, this economic theory that says that there's no arbitrage in the foreign exchange markets and the money markets that broke up in the August 2007, and it's really. Then afterwards, the research has tried to figure out why this is the case and what's really happening. How could one economic relationship apply from around 1970s till to the great financial crisis and net 10 not apply after that? So that's a big research question. And if you're interested in these topics, please check this Tepper and Verdel Journal of Finance, I believe it was 2008, is really, really famous article about this theoretical relationship. And basically this article says that it is a new regulations and policies of the central banks have affected to the behavior of the currencies, so that they're systematically differentiating or not going, they're not behaving as they used to behave. Yeah, then we are asked to interpret the model, and we are interpreting the model here using the hedge ratio. So we see here dynamic patterns that are varying over time. So this implies that in a raw theory that our hedge ratio is also good. It could be also be the case that our hedge ratio is varying over time. So let's interpret this model a little bit further. And first of all, we save some results. And then we'll check the hedge ratio. So here the standard deviation of the bound refers to the British pound is as a denominator here. So let's save their correlations. And then let's make this series as a time series. And then let's start plotting the data. So first of all, earlier I talked about this breakup of the covered interest rate parity. I talked about that. So here again, we can see from here that hedge ratios of these currencies are behaving quite nicely till around 2007, 2008, and afterwards there seems to be breakup, and there's a negative. The relationship between the series become negative when the blue series is going downwards, the red series is going upwards, and then again they seem to come back, but actually in one way they seem to be also, their relationship seems to be, their correlation seems to be negative also after that, but it's not that extreme as it was earlier. Here, but it's more the same as before this before they deviated more widely. Then let's check the another series. And yeah, this is the pound against the Japanese yen and the euro against the Japanese yen, and they're moving really closely together. Alexandra, do you want to add anything to this series, or do you want what do you want to show next?
I think I should go through the state echoes briefly, though the results are the same, but the syntax is a bit different.
Yes, so let's do it that in this way. There's a small forecasting part for these DCC correlations, but that's something that could help you later on with something, though. That here is only static forecast for the DCC card model, but as we skipped the forecasting in the previous part, so if you're interested in studying the out of sample prediction accuracy of the model, here's some code for you, but it is not important here. So I'll stop sharing here, and
yep. Okay, here we go. This is the code and data for question one. So here, first we are importing the data and declaring the dataset to be time series dataset. So let's run this lines. Yep, and yep, and now we can see here that we have monthly data from January 1991 to December 2020. Here we're plotting the spread, just like by writing line, the y axis variable spread, and the x axis variable date. Let's run it. Here is the graph. Then in stator, as I told earlier, if you want to specify the subsample, you have to use this if condition. So here the first subsample is before September 2008. Here we're generating the interest rate variables and spread before September 2008. And then in stator, Dickey-Fuller test is a little bit, is less stricter than in R, in a sense that the critical values are interpolated, and that's why sometimes when, for example, R is saying that there is a unit root in the data, then instead you might find that this variable can actually be stationary if you consider, for example, not the 1% or 5% level, but let's say 10% significance level. So here we run the Dickey-Fuller test for the interest rates. Yeah, and for the T-bill rate, we can strongly say that there is a unit root, because the p-value for the test statistic is higher than 10%. However, for the long-term yield, we can assert that there is a unit root at 5% significant level, but at 10% significant level, we can say that it is actually stationary. Then we do the Dickey-Fuller test for the differences. And yeah, here the p-value is zero, meaning that the first difference are stationary. So we fulfill the necessary condition for co-integration at this point. Then same in our algorithm, we're creating a linear regression model for the t-bill rate on a constant and long-term yield, and printing the summary statistics of the linear regression. So here we just like type regress, and here is the dependent variable t-bill rate, and then it's followed by the independent variable long-term yield. Let's run it. Yeah, and here is how the OLS regression table looks like in Stater. And we can see that both the constant and the coefficient of long-term yield are statistically significant. And now we need to save the residuals of the linear regression model. So we do it just by typing predict, and then we give the name of the residuals where we want to store them, then comma, and you have to specify residuals. Let's run it. And now let's test the residuals for the stationarity. Yep. So here are the results of the Dickey-Fuller test. And looking at the p-value of the test statistic, we can say that the residuals are actually, they are stationary at 5% and 10% significant level, but however, if we take 1% more precise significance level, 1%, then it actually has the unit root. But let's assume that we take the 5% level for our research purposes. And then we need to create the error correction model using the differences of the T-bill and long-term yield rates. Here we just line 44 write regress, and then we specify the difference of the T-bill as an independent variable, followed by the independent variables, the difference of their long-term yield and the first log of our residuals. Let's run it. And yeah, the same result as Juha showed you in R. So we can see that the coefficient of the first difference of long-term yield is insignificant, meaning that there is no short-term effect of long-term yield on the T-bill rate. But however, there is a long-term effect because the coefficient is negative and significant for the residuals, for the first lack of the residuals. And now it's also possible to test the quality of the model by testing the residuals for autocorrelation. Let's do it. And here is the table, and the null hypothesis is that there is no autocorrelation in the residuals, and so here we have to, we're looking at the left side of the table because the right side of the table, it specified the autocorrelation test for specific lags. That's not what we're interested in. Here we take lags from first to 20th. And as you can see that the p-value is zero, meaning that we cannot accept the null hypothesis. So this means that there is autocorrelation in the residuals and the model actually is not, cannot be trusted much. And then the same thing here for the second subsample after September 2008. But maybe you can go through it on your own. Now, let me switch to the next question. So for the currency data set, we're importing the data, calculating the returns, plotting the pound US return series. Yeah, here is how the graph looks like. It looks a little bit crowded on the axis, but you can always change it by just like using this graph editor here. So you do the right click on the axis, and there is axis properties. So you can see the options here, how to do that. And then and then we're testing for arch effects, just like the same way as we do in R. We regress the British pound US returns on a constant and save the residual, square them, and then take the first five lags. Let's do that. Let's run it. And now we regress the squared residuals on the first five lags. Yep, and yeah, again, the same output as in R, four out of five lags are significantly different from zero, meaning that there are arch effects in the British pound US return series. Then we're going back to the code. And yeah, this is a fun part. So I personally, I think I already told her that I like graphics in Stata much more than in R. So first, let's plot the fitted values and residuals. And here, if you want to scale the graph, the scatter graph, then you have to do it through the if condition. So here I specify that I want to see the fitted values only less than 3 and residuals less than 15. Just without extreme outliers. And here how the graph looks like. And then here we can also plot the residuals of Arch 5 model. Also, we have to scale it a little bit in order to be like more representative. And then also the squared residual. You can also see the histogram here. And also, like, you always have to scale it a little bit through if condition, because otherwise it does not scale it automatically. So it's not very representative then. Actually, I can show that if we, for example, get rid of this if part and run without it, then yeah, you can see that like absolutely nothing is visible. So you have to always take care of the scaling. And here is the density plot, also scaled. And this Q norm plot is also possible. And from here, like, we can apparently see that residuals do not follow the normal distribution. Yep, and that was for the whole subsample. And here I'm testing the arch effects for the period before September 2008 and after that. Maybe I will skip it. And we're estimating the GARCH 1-1 model with ARMA 1-1 for the mean. I think the code is quite intuitive here. So like, you just first specify arch command, then the variable, and then after the comma, you are specifying the number of flux of each part. So here we're taking one arch lag, one GARCH lag, and we want to use ARIMA 1-1 for the mean. Let's run it to see the reporting. Oh yeah, and by the way, by the default, Stata used the normal distribution for the errors. So yeah, that's how the GARCH 1-1 with ARMA 1-1 reporting table looks like in Stata. And actually, it seems a good model, because like, R and R parts are both significant, and alpha and beta In some they give around 1 and they are both significant. Yeah. So if you won't specify ARIMA 101 here, then by the default stator will build GARCH 1 with ARMA 00 for the mean. And if you want to specify the distribution of errors in GARCH estimation to be student t, then you have to add in this part distribution in parentheses t. And then you can also do that for the first subsample and second subsample. Yeah, and in stata there is no direct equivalent to GJR GARCH 1-1, which is available in R, but instead there is an option of GJR form of threshold GARCH model. So here you specify an additional so-called TARCH term. Let's run it. Yeah, maybe I forgot to run there. This part of code. Yeah, this one, I think. Yes, let's run it now. It should be fine. No, it's this is strange. This one. Yeah, now it's working. So yeah, now here you also can see this starch term. And your like model looks not bad in a way that the arch starch and garch terms are all significant here. However, stator, I must say, is quite mean in reporting of related tests when you want to know more about the quality of the model. In this way, R is more advanced because it provides you the automatically designed bias tests, for example, and lots of other tests which can help you to figure out the quality of your model. And then there is also an option of eGARCH model. So just before ARCH here, you have to add E, and then these two terms will now refer to the ARCH and GARCH of exponential ARCH and GARCH terms. Yeah, maybe I should run it to show you the some plots. And yeah, the same graph as in R, residuals of the squared residuals of the eGARCH model with conditional variance estimated here. And now I'm doing the same for the second subsample. And for the GARCH in mean, you have to, after ARCH 1-1, GARCH 1-1, you have to specify this ARCH M term. Let's run it. Yep, and here are the results. And actually, mean term is not significant, so like it doesn't make much sense to add it. And And now the last question is about was about multivariate catch modeling. So instead, there mCatch command provides estimates for three most popular conditional correlation models. These are constant, dynamic, and varying condition correlation. So here is line 149 specifies the constant conditional correlation model, and then 159 is the dynamic conditional correlation. And here, if we want to plot the time-varying correlations, then first we have to predict the variances of the model. So, yeah, after you write predict and give some name like H star to the variance, it will automatically calculate the variances and covariances of the series that you give data. And you have to calculate the correlation yourself. So here I'm calculating the pairwise dynamic correlations. And we can also plot it. Yeah, and here how they all three of them look together on one graph. And then same as in R, we can also calculate the optimal pairwise time varying hedge ratios. Let's do that. And yeah, let's plot. So yeah, exactly the same graph as in R, but just like with more fancy display, I would say. And so yeah, we can see the British pound against Japanese yen hedge ratio is more in moving in tandem with the hedge ratio of euro against Japanese yen rather than the previous graph. So yeah, that's it. I think that's all I wanted to share. Yep.
So thank you. So this was this session, and you have your last lectures this on Wednesday and Thursday, and we'll have our last demos next week, and then there's some more work to do. So I hope you have a nice week and see you around.
Thank you.
So Alexandra, can you please send me the video?
Oh yeah. Let me stop it.